Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of the Forgotten Volunteer, a hero of the 1916 Rising, whose story is perhaps well known in Cork, but not further afield, Thomas Kent. In recent weeks, we've looked at the life and work of Rembrandt, the music of Dvorak, Jerusalem, the history of a city, and lots more in our book shows. So if you want to listen back to any of these shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, though, we're looking at the life and legacy of Thomas Kent. Born in County Cork in 1865, Thomas Kent became involved in the Land League agitation of the 1880s and was briefly imprisoned. A member of the Gaelic League, he joined the Cork Brigade of the Volunteers in 1914 and was sentenced to prison for illegal possession of arms at the start of 1916. Released at the outbreak of the Rising, he waited for a nationwide rebellion, and on the night of the 1st to the 2nd of May, he became involved in a gunfight at his home when it was raided by the RIC. He and his brother William were captured and tried by court-martial. William was acquitted, but Thomas was executed by firing squad on the 9th of May 1916. In 1966, the railway station in Cork was renamed in his honour, and in 2015 he was given a state funeral, with Taoiseach Enda Kenny calling him someone who had worked for the goal of Irish freedom and who had paid the ultimate sacrifice. So in tonight's show we want to explore his life and his legacy. And to help me do this, I'm very fortunate to be joined by three of the leading experts on the Irish Revolution for the full discussion. Dr. Brian Hughes, who lectures at Mary Immaculate College, Limerick, and whose books include a biography of one of the executed 1916 leaders, Michael Mallon, part of the 16 Live series. Dr. John Borgonova, who lectures at UCC and whose books include The Dynamics of War and Revolution, Cork City, 1916 to 1918. He was also one of the editors of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution. Lorcan Collins is an historian whose books include 1916, The Rising Handbook. He organises the 1916 Rebellion Walking Tour and has a new podcast on Irish history called Revolutionary Ireland. Well, you're all very welcome. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Meadha Ryan, an historian and author whose books include Thomas Kent, part of that 16 Live series as well, and Sean Enright, the distinguished historian and judge whose books include Easter Rising 1916, The Trials, and After the Rising, Soldiers, Lawyers and Trials of the Irish Revolution. Well, as I say, you are indeed very welcome. And Brian, I might begin with you with a big broad question about commemoration. And I suppose it's about how Thomas Kent has been remembered throughout Irish history, because I suspect up until that state funeral in 2015, he probably wasn't very well known in this country, and perhaps even now he maybe doesn't have quite the recognition that he deserves.
I think, as you mentioned at the outset, outside of Cork, he's probably not remembered very much at all, or certainly wasn't up until 2015, 2016. And I'm sure very many of the people who regularly pass Kent Station had no idea the man after whom it was named, or indeed about the family after which it was named. Kent, there's a case to be made for Kent as maybe the least well-known of the executed leaders, but even still, he fits in a kind of a place there. Certainly, the executed leaders in terms of 1916 are at the top of the hierarchy, and there are very clear hierarchies in terms of remembrance and 1916 signatories. Even within the executed leaders are out on their own. You could argue Pearson Connolly up at the top. Constance Markovich might also make her way in there as well. But in some ways, it's kind of an accident of the fact that he was executed that Kent even fits into that bracket at all. We might compare him to Richard Kent, who was also killed at Bonnard House, and is even less well known, less well remembered than Kent was. So while he is one of the least well known executed leaders, he has been remembered in a way that many others who died in 1916 aren't, like his brother Richard. Kent gets a portrait very quickly. One of those famous Sinn Féin rebellion postcards. You know, there's a Thomas Kent postcard. There are Sinn Féin clubs named after him. A number of Sinn Féin clubs named after him by 1923. There's actually a Thomas Kent's Camogie team playing fixtures in Cork in 1917, and then you have, as you mentioned, the train station being named in his honour in 1966. So there is commemoration, there is remembrance, and certainly plays out as well in the careers of his surviving brothers.
John, it's a very interesting part of the 1916 story, and it's perhaps a part of the story that doesn't get that attention. When we think of 1916, you automatically think of the GPO and you think of the fighting in Boland's Mill, and it's Dublin, it's a Dublin story. But here we have an important Cork story, and it adds an extra layer and an extra dimension to the whole 1916 rising.
Yeah, well, if we think about what happened, you know, you had this well-organized Irish volunteer network, not just in Cork, but across Munster and Kerry and in Limerick, Tipperary, and they were all stood down because of the confusion over the countermanding order by Owen McNeill, and there was real chaos across the Irish volunteer network, and especially in Cork. And so what you this is kind of a byproduct of it, which is folks didn't really know what to do. They didn't act. They kind of stood by on standby waiting for orders that never came. And then at the end of the rising, the police went out and they arrested a lot of the leaders of the volunteer network, again, not just in Cork, but across Munster. And in the case of the Kents, they resisted arrest in pretty dramatic fashion. And it kind of when you think about just the homestead, the fact that it's all the brothers there, they're kind of their 85-year-old mom shouting on, you know, loading weapons and shouting defiance. It's pretty dramatic stuff. And even if it wasn't really remembered that well outside of Cork, it made a pretty profound impact here. Even the funeral for Richard was quite well attended in, you know, a week later after his death in 1916. And the return of David Kent from prison was a massive demonstration as well. So they would have been quite well remembered. It made the event made a pretty big impact on the public consciousness in Cork and just really around Munster.
And John, it's interesting what you say about that battle at the homestead, and I'll talk to Lorcan further about that. But in a way, it's not even that they were striking a blow for Ireland or for freedom, that there is an element of self-defense to that as well, that the RIC brought the fight to their house.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting that they didn't execute Thomas Kent for murder. They executed him for you know, rebellion, because probably they weren't entirely confident of a murder plea. I mean, we'll let Larkin talk about the actual events at the house. But I always thought it was that's part of the reason it stood up was it's an isolated, big, strong house, isolated, defending your castle. For me as an American, it always felt like something like out of the Wild West, you know, kind of the people defending the ranch as folks come. And I think that was, it really kind of had a psychological dimension to it that raised morale. It was just a real act of defiance. Not just by Thomas Kent, but by the entire family.
Very good. Well, Lorcan, let's talk about this Wild West gunfight in early May 1916, because I've read different accounts and sometimes there can be differences in terms of how long the battle was and even in terms of lines of dialogue. You hear some dramatic reconstruction of what was said. So as best you've been able to piece it together, what happened?
Okay, well, just before I say that, we have to remember that the Kents made the name of the Land League very famous in Cork. They were really dedicated to trying to destroy the scourge of landlordism. And I know you're going to talk about that later in the show anyway, but it's not that they were just some random kind of guys that the police decided to arrest. They were very much at the forefront of the movement all through their lives. And they're a fantastic family of seven boys, you know, four of whom ended up in this incredible fight. I love what John describes it as, the Wild West. I used to always tell the story that the mother, who was 81, she got various ages through her life, and every story seemed to increase her age. I think the last one was 85 or 86, but she's like Ma Baker, because she was loading the weapons for them. Now, they were very poorly armed in the house. They had three shotguns and one rifle and a decent amount of ammunition. So it did last a good long time. Now, on the 2nd of May, just to remind your listeners, the rising was over in Dublin by the 29th of April, when the surrender occurred. A few days later, the police are told, arrest Sinn Féin suspects in the area, and top of the list were people like the Savages and the Kents. So the police went down to Bonnard House, which was a fine big establishment, a two-storey 8 windows at the front, you know. And of course, they knocked at the door at 2:30 in the morning, and William it was who woke up, and he woke the rest of the lads. They went downstairs into the hall, and the police shouted, "Open up, you know, we're here to arrest you." And I think it was Thomas, it's always claimed, who said, in the name of the Republic, we'll never surrender," or words to that effect. And it's not really clear who fired the first shots, but I believe it may have been the police who unleashed a volley at the house, and in return the lads took to a few windows and engaged the RIC, the police. One section of them, there wasn't even that many of them, 8 or 9, one section of them went to the left hand side, the other went to the right, and a few were in the front. And it was Head Constable William Rowe who took a bullet to the head, and sadly for him and for his family, he died. So the rest of the police decided it might be a good idea to send for reinforcements, which came from the Cadet Training School, a British Army training school, which was in Moor Park near Fermoy. And 50 to 100 cadets came down, and they brought machine guns with them, and 5 trucks. And of course, more of a battle went on. There wasn't a window pane left in the whole house. There wasn't plaster left on the walls. And it was a fierce gun battle. David was badly wounded in the fingers. I think he lost the tops of 2 of his fingers and in the side. And eventually, anyway, when they had no more ammunition left, there was another box of ammunition discovered later, but they must have missed it. They decided on surrender after hours of a gun battle. So it must have been incredible. Now, poor old Richard, who was a very well-known athlete, he won medals for the GAA and for running and cross-country, but he decided to try and, in the confusion, to try and make a break for it. And 2 of the cadets, the British Army, shot him, and he died from his wounds a couple of days later, as we know. So a very unfortunate incident, but one that put Cork on the map for 1916.
And John, it's interesting to hear the gunfight described like that, because it was it made this a significant military engagement that was part of the 1916 story.
Yeah, we know that there was a significant activity up in Galway, a rising down in Enniscorthy, and then Thomas Ashe's outfit kind of running out north of Dublin. But and Munster was quiet, and it was quite a demoralizing experience for them, because the Munster units were really well organized and well armed, relatively speaking, and a lot was expected for them, which is why they planned to land weapons down in County Kerry. So when those organizations just basically sat out and in some cases surrendered their weapons without firing a shot, it was really humiliating. And so this was a kind of an act of defiance that raised morale. And even though it was isolated, even though it wasn't planned, it had a psychological impact. And as you know, we just heard too, one of the things about the Kents is the Kents are quite respectable. They're experienced agitators. They're also big, strong farmers. They're teetotalers. They're devout Catholics. So they tick a lot of boxes as well. And it's kind of the family unit standing up to the empire. I think also it was one of the reasons it made such an impact locally.
Very good. And I'll shortly be talking to Meadow Ryan about the early life of Thomas Kent and his involvement in the Land League agitation and all of that. And I'll also be talking to Sean Enright then about the court-martial and what happened there. But Brian, I'm kind of interested in terms of the execution of Thomas Kent, how the image of him created there. Was that a significant part of the story afterwards? It was always said that he died gripping his set of rosary beads, that there were various quotes attributed to him showing defiant heroism. And was that an important part of the story as well? That I think even in one of the British military reports, he said he didn't show a flicker of fear, or not a feather of fear, that he died a hero's death as well.
I think that's very much the case. And as John said, the fact that Kent is a devout Catholic and a teetotaler and all these things, allowed him to tick those boxes. And the execution, the way Kent's execution is described, is actually very similar to the way many of the executions in Dublin are described. So it's not that unusual to hear these comments where the person set up to be executed has said something defiant, has acted bravely, you know, refused eye covering or whatever it might be. And things like rosary beads fit very nicely into the image of the 1916 leaders as these devout Catholics and the kind of the adoption of you know, the Catholicism, the creation of that kind of Catholic myth that comes with the Rising as well, fits in there nicely. And the rosary beads are interesting because in 1966 at the Golden Jubilee, a decade of the rosary was set at events at Collins Barracks, what was then Collins Barracks, where they're supposed to have been said with the very rosary beads held by Kent when he was executed. Now, whether anyone can confirm the provenance of the rosary beads is another matter, but certainly, again, that link is made very clearly in 66. And the grave itself becomes a key site for 1916 commemoration. Bonnard House remains a family home, but certainly in terms of giving Cork that very real physical connection to the Rising, at the site of Kent's burial plays an important role, and that's really where the commemorative events happen from 1916 right the way up until the events in 2015 when Kent is given the state funeral. There's a great quote when what was then Glanmire Station was renamed. The Lord Mayor of Cork at the time claimed that the Kent family had redeemed the spirit of County Cork and lit the flame here in the south. And the sort of, you know, the events at Bonnard House and then the execution of Kent and his burial gives for Moy and it gives Cork that very real link to 1916, which becomes very important and features very prominently in commemoration afterwards.
Okay, well, we're talking history and tonight we are debating the life and legacy of Thomas Kent. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back I'll be talking to the wonderful Meadha Ryan about the early life of Thomas Kent, his involvement in the Land League agitation, his time in Boston, and also get her insights into this remarkable character. We'll be back with more on Talking History right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Thomas Kent. And it's a real pleasure to be joined on the phone by Meadha Ryan. She's a prolific historian and author, and most recently the book Thomas Kent, part of the 16 Lives series published by the O'Brien Press. Meadha, can we talk about some of the aspects of Thomas Kent's life that perhaps are not very well known? For example, his involvement in the Land League agitation and the plan of campaign pain in the 1880s and so on, that this was someone who had quite a substantial contribution to different phases of Irish history.
That's right, yes. Actually, I would say that Thomas Kent is one of Ireland's forgotten patriots, though he was the 13th of the 16 men executed in the aftermath of the Easter Rising in 1916. He was the only man executed in Cork and the only man with a direct connection to the Land League because he was involved in it.
And talk to me about that Land League agitation, because he was imprisoned during that time and he seems to have been a significant figure.
He was really. He was from Bonnard House. He was the fourth eldest of nine children born to David Kent and Mary Rice. And they were tenant farmers and they were born before the famine. So for an early age, Thomas, he was known as Thomas Rice Kent. His mother gave him her Christian name. He developed a knowledge of what his ancestors had endured, and he was steeped in the Fenian tradition. And his father's cousin, David Kent, and John McCarthy, they participated in the Cork 1867 Rising. Then he was friendly with his cousin, John Curtin Kent, and he was involved with Tom Clark and O'Donovan Ross and others in the London Dynamite Campaign. So Curtin's Kent torture and endurance over 12 years in English jails helped Thomas later in his imprisonment. But Thomas was only 10 when his father died, and his father was only 44, and his younger brother was barely a year old, and his sister of 12 years had already died. So it was a very difficult time for him. And at that time, in the 1870s, life wasn't easy with so many young children. She had seven sons and a daughter. And Mary, she was strong and resourceful, and she took a lease in Bonnard House, and that's where they lived, and it was very difficult to keep paying the rent. But in his early teens, he joined his older brother Edmund in the Land League, And he was only 17 when he went to Boston, and he got employment in Noonan's for furnishing and bookbinding business. And this company was, they were relatives of his mother's family, Noonan's. And once he was there, he joined the Irish Philo-Celtic Society. His social life changed, and he got deeply involved in cultural activities and the Irish language, and the fact that they were bilingual, all the Kents were. He helped in the formation of an Irish school. And this became extremely successful, and he was able to promote the love of Ireland. And throughout his years in Boston, he studied Irish history and learned how the English treated the Irish, how they, in their governments, that they were very hard and strong-willed against them. So he began to write about these events in the Boston Irish Echo. Then his older brother James and his younger brother David, they joined him later. But during those interesting years in Boston, home rule was very important in Ireland, but it was very important to the Irish American Society in America and in Boston. And by 1886, Thomas, he was on the board of directors in the Philo-Celtic Society in Boston. And he was responsible for many activities in the Irish American school. So he was an intellectual, really. And by this time, he was leading an active social life. He organized concerts, and he had a girlfriend, and he Kayleigh's and so on. His life was doing. He was doing well. So his mother, of course, was continuing to pay the rent at home. But he made a trip home in 1887, and this brought him in contact with the Landleague, as you mentioned earlier, Landleague issues, and he got to know John Mansfield, and he was a National League activist, and William O'Brien, and he learned of the reality of life for the tenant farmer, and how boycotting could work. And what became known as afterwards as the Mitchelstown Massacre. Remember, he was only home just for a holiday at this stage, you know, a fairly long holiday. And he was there that day, it's an important event in Irish history. And the police, they followed Balfour's order, which was, do not hesitate to shoot. And the police took his order, and they shot and batten charged thousands of tenant farmers they had gathered against injustices that were being wrought on them. So that day, the police, they killed three people, and they really badly wounded many more. Some of them were crippled with their batten charging and rifle butting. But Mandeville, one of the leaders, he was arrested, and he was treated so harshly in jail that shortly after his release, then he died suddenly. He was only 38 years of age.
And going back to Thomas Kent, he was in prison for 2 months hard labour. And
that's
Do we know what the prison conditions were like?
Oh, the prison conditions were very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. Because hard labour, like, they slept on a plank bed, and they didn't... they got no food or anything. But Thomas returned to Boston then, and... he had founded his own publishing company. He was doing great, and he had no intention of, I suppose, coming home. But anyhow, he returned home suddenly 2 years later, because there was a trial of his brothers Edmund, David, William and Richard, and with a local priest and neighbours, and they were charged under Balfour, under his act, and they were orchestrating a boycotting campaign. And the reason was that Thomas's cousin, Richard Rice, his farm and his in-cool and his labourers, they were wrongly evicted from the farm in 1887. So this was 2 years later. And his farm, to tell you how it happened, the farm was sold to a Northern Ireland landlord who owned vast estates right in Cork, right into Fort Island. And he got an agent named Robert Brown to manage the farm. And it came to a head when Edmund, David, William, these were Thomas's brothers, and Richard, They were with Father O'Dwyer, a local priest, and neighbours, and they were all charged with boycotting. And there was no consideration given to the fact that Richard Rice, Thomas's cousin, that he had been evicted, and he spent he had also spent a considerable sum, $2,500, on doing up his farm. But it was a time when the crime, it came under the Crimes Act, that people could be just evicted if a landlord wanted the land from somebody. And
Mita, your work has been great at also exploring, I suppose, the impact of the family on Irish politics, because of course alongside Thomas you had David and you had William.
That's right.
And you had Richard, and of course Thomas and William tried by court-martial, David seriously wounded, Richard killed during the gunfight in 1916. It was a family that felt strongly about the cause of Irish freedom.
That's right. You see, when the boycotting campaign, when Parnell, he brought in, he introduced the boycotting to discourage tenants from bidding from other people's land. And when this was done, it was known as land grabbing. But the Kents, then in that time, you see, the brothers, they sort of worked as a team. And when they were being arrested, one of them paid God Save Ireland. Edmund shouted, "Death or victory is our war cry," and so on. They wouldn't surrender. And Richard then, because he was so young, he was only 14 years old, he was the only one that wasn't arrested at the time, and he was left at home and with his mother. So Thomas stayed with him, and they worked outside the farm to try and help the farm. So, you know, to help in the farming, and it was depressed. Farming was in a depressed state at the time, and Thomas got deeply involved in that plan of campaign. And the brothers, they were fighting for a principle. And you see, then because of that, Thomas was determined that his mother would hold on to her holding. So he set up a branch of the Land League. So by now he wasn't returning to Boston, obviously, and his life there, and he having set up a publishing company and so on. But they were in and out of jail then, and they were arrested, and of course, court cases are fascinating. They went on for days. And in another case, Richard Rice, who was the man that was evicted, he was arrested and he was convicted. And I mean, it was very difficult and a difficult time.
Okay, well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Mita, to talk to you tonight. Mita Ryan, author of Thomas Kent, part of the 16 Live series. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Sean Enright about the court-martial of Thomas Kent.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Thomas Kent. It's a real honour and pleasure to be joined by Sean Enright, the distinguished historian and judge in the UK. He's the author of Easter Rising 1916, The Trials, and After the Rising, Soldiers, Lawyers and Trials of the Irish Revolution. And of course, most recently, The Irish Civil War, Law, Execution and Atrocity. Sean, can I ask you about what happened after Kent was captured, after the big shootout? What was he charged with?
He was charged with murder and rebellion with intent to assist the enemy, namely Germany. That was because the legal regime he was tried under was the Defence of the Realm Act, which was passed at the outbreak of the Great War. And that allowed trial by court-martial in the event of rebellion or invasion. And it was only possible to execute the prisoner where it was proved the prisoner had intended to assist the enemy.
I was a little surprised that his brother William was acquitted, but that Thomas was convicted, because I would have thought that perhaps the same evidence might have acquitted both or convicted both.
The evidence given was exactly the same in respect of both men, except that a single RIC officer gave a character statement for William Kent. And my view is the tribunal would be given a steer as direction they took. There was no difference in the substantive evidence against either man.
And
by way of background, it should be said, the four brothers were captured Richard was mortally wounded trying to escape. David Kent was badly wounded, and the barracks doctor refused to sign him off as fit for trial. And that left only two prisoners, Thomas and William. And they were both tried within 48 hours of capture. William was acquitted. Thomas was convicted. It rather looks as though the RIC were particularly after Thomas. But the evidence as to who fired the fatal shot was entirely equivocal. And looking at matters in the round, having researched the subject, it's pretty clear that the man who fired the shot was David Kent. Later tried, convicted, he had his sentence reduced to 5 years.
So in terms of the trial itself then, do you think it was lawful, and was the conviction, is there a doubt about the conviction then because he probably shouldn't have been sentenced to death?
I think it's unlikely, highly unlikely a jury would have convicted him on that evidence. As to whether the trial was lawful, my take on it is not did he do it, but was due process observed, and it is very plain that it was not. The army purported to try these men under the regime set out in the Defence of the Realm Act, but it's now very clear that the army had avoided all the significant legal protections there were for prisoners. They quite simply drove a coach and horses through the legislation. All the prisoners were tried after the rebellion by field general court-martial, which meant there was no legal officer on the panel, and there was no defence lawyer. And all the trials took place in camera. There was no access to the trials by press or public. No opportunity for prisoners to have access to defence witnesses or to prepare a defence, and not even access to the rules under which the trial were taking place. And I don't think in those circumstances Kent would have realised that the cornerstone of the case against him was an intention to assist Germany. No evidence was actually called about him intending to assist Germany. And there the matter rests. All the trials conducted after the rebellion suffered from these legal flaws.
And why were the bodies of those that were executed, why were they not released for burial by General Maxwell afterwards?
I think the thinking was that the funerals and the graves would become a focus for discontent. And for that reason, all the prisoners were buried in quicklime. And that's how things stood for very many years.
The fact that they were so quick afterwards to destroy the trial records, or at least attempt to destroy them, kind of undermines their own sense of these things being correct and legitimate. It seems that they were in a real hurry to try and remove all the evidence that things perhaps hadn't been quite as proper as they should have been.
The full picture is this, that the records of men who were executed were preserved. But an order was made by Lloyd George. They'd be kept covered up for 100 years. The rest of the trial records were destroyed, or thought to have been destroyed. And that was done, it's said, by the Public Record Office as part of a routine cull. Why it was done, we'll never know. But fortunately, I was able to find about 20 more trial records. Countess Markievicz's trial, a copy of that was sent to the Home Office before the destruction order was made, and her trial record survived by chance. There were also 16 in the Irish military archive in a box marked contemporary documents, which were mouldering quietly for very many years, and two more in the Gavin Duffy papers. So 100 years on, it's been possible to build up a very clear picture of all that took place.
And finally, do you think what happened to Thomas Kent then, was it a miscarriage of justice?
Well, as I say, it's not the question, did he do it, but was due process observed? And very plainly, even by the standards of the time, due process was not observed, either in relation to him or any of the other prisoners tried.
Okay, well, my thanks to Sean Enright, whose brilliant scholarship has brought so many of these cases and the real story behind the cases to light in recent years. Sean Enright will be back with more on the life and the legacy of Thomas Kent right after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Thomas Kent. And I'm rejoined by our full panel, Dr. Brian Hughes, author of Michael Mallon, Dr. John Borgonovo, one of the editors of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution, and Lorcan Collins, author of 1916, The Rising Handbook, and the man behind the new podcast, revolutionary Ireland. Brian, I might ask you about maybe some of the commemorations in the decades after independence then. How was Thomas Kent remembered in Cork?
The primary form of commemoration is an annual event. By the 1920s, there's a very regular laying of a wreath at his grave. And it's quite interesting that they seem to know, or think they know very early on, where exactly Kent was buried. There are accounts that locals are looking after the grave in the 1920s, the defence forces are looking after it in the 1930s, and that there is a, you know, that it's been railed off and that a black cross has been erected. Most of the time, though, it's family commemoration. So members of the family come and lay a wreath, and it gets reported in the press. But actually, in 1935, they briefly opened the site to the public, and apparently a large number of people availed of that opportunity. So most of the time, it's this kind of family event that happens locally and gets reported in the local press. There are also commemorative events at Castle Lyons, at the church in Castle Lyons as well. And in contrast, as state commemoration develops in the 1930s, there's always the alternative to the state commemoration as well. So at the Golden Jubilee, the state events place in Collins Barracks and at Kent's grave, but there are also alternative Republican events organised in Castle Lyons and Fermoy. The National Commemoration Committee, Sinn Féin's National Commemoration Committee, hold parades as a kind of a counter to the state events, which is a tradition that goes right back to the 1920s. So in many ways, the commemoration of Kent very closely mirrors what happens at Arbour Hill over the course of the 1920s, 30s and onwards. It just happens in Cork and it's very localised.
Lorcan, was there any recognition for the family afterwards? What did the government do in terms of, say, pensions or medals or any kind of honours like that?
Right. The simple answer is no. There was no recognition, right? First of all, there was no compensation given to them till the mid-1920s for the damage that had been done to their house by the police and the British Army, absolutely destroying it. The poor mother, who had worked so hard to keep this beautiful house in order and to keep her land, it never went back to the house after it. She died in January 1917, so she never got back to her home. The two brothers who were left alive who had been in the battle, now that's David, who was wounded badly and who lost the fingers as well, and William, who had been tried but acquitted. They applied for pensions and for medals as well. It's bizarre who didn't get a medal for 1916. You know, no one ever applied for a medal for Countess Markowitz. George and Jack Plunkett never got a medal for 1916 either. So the two dead lads, Thomas, who was executed, and Richard, who died from his wounds, they got the medal. But sure, it was no use to them. They were dead and gone. But the two lads who wanted recognition for being in that important battle were never given a medal, which is just kind of pathetic. And it's quite a good example of how badly the medals were issued. You know, sometimes I really take the head off people when they say to me, all those fellas just did it for the medals. Like, it's not so much that, it's just the recognition and to be given some sort of compensation for, I know it sounds crass in some ways when people say it, but they fought for Ireland, you know, by all accounts. And that's what the medals and the pensions were for. And it seems particularly pathetic that they were never fully recognised and that they died without that recognition later on.
And when the train station was renamed in the honour, was that some kind of...
You know, they were all dead and gone by then. Yeah. You know, that's the thing, Patrick. You, as usual in Ireland, you're never recognised until you're dead and gone. Like, so, you know, it would have been some sort of solace for them, I think, that they lost their two brothers if they had been recognised and given medals at the time for taking part in what was the only action in rebel Cork in 1916.
John, there's an extraordinary after story to this incident then, and to the story of Thomas Kent. The fact that there was this huge state funeral for him in 2015, that in the lead up to the centenary of the Rising, his story was told again, and this forgotten volunteer, as he was described in one account, he got suddenly all of this attention and honour and recognition.
Yeah, the body had been, you know, in place where he was shot. They kind of just buried him close to where he was executed in, you know, throwing lime on top of it and what have you. There was a tradition where his remains were, and a marker was put down, I think, in the 30s. And as we just heard, there was also, you know, some early commemorations at that time. For some reason, officials convinced themselves that the body wasn't on that exact spot, and there was concern that it could be kind of almost anywhere. And it wasn't until kind of a significant effort was made to locate the remains that forensic archaeologists by the state from the OPW were brought in and actually conducted the dig. And they started on the traditional spot that was supposed to contain the remains. And they dug down and they immediately struck a marker and they immediately found the remains, which they were able to identify. And they were, I think they were kind of very pleasantly surprised that it was that easy to recover, because they were thinking it could be any place, or that it could be, you know, that there wouldn't be enough remains left to recover. So that was kind of the basis for this removal, and which was pretty dramatic. I went up there, and it was the evening before, there were thousands of people from Cork City kind of came up, and then the actual ceremony itself up in Castle Lyons, I mean, it was pretty remarkable. It was a really good way of beginning that commemorative year of 2016, I thought.
And Lorcan, how did you feel the state, the government handled this then? Was this an appropriate event?
I very much enjoyed the whole state funeral for Thomas. You know, I know some people got very irked. They got wound up by it. How dare we commemorate such a great hero? Personally, I was overjoyed to see after 99 years that he was given right recognition, the correct recognition. And when myself and Ruan O'Donnell were getting together for the 16 Live series, we did discuss, who do we do? Will we do the 14 men executed in Kilmainham Jail? And I have always believed 16 men were executed for their role in the Rising. So we would always include Thomas Kent. But I was amazed at how few people knew who he was. Even people from down that neck of the woods, they might know the station, but that was about it. So I really think 2015 was a good time, rather than 2016, to do it, because it would have, you know, been hidden in the various other events of that year. So it was a great time to do it. And I know 99 years is a terrible long time to wait to be repatriated into consecrated ground. But finally, it was done. You know, sometimes we move very slowly in Ireland. I'm sure you agree. But he's certainly always in my mind being one of the great 16 executed for their role.
Because as you say, the 14 and the two, everyone thinks of the other one, Roger Casement. But Thomas Kent is kind of the quiz question. Do you think he's more remembered now? Does he have a greater profile in the country because of the books, because of this state funeral, and that he's been kind of brought back into the story?
I think so. You know, Meada Ryan, I'm always saying she deserves an actual medal for the amount of work that she did on Thomas Kent. She saved him from being obscure. A lot of those men, our friend here, Brian Hughes, saved the memory of Michael Mallon as well. There was so little written about those lesser executed. I'm using the inverted commas. And it's great that people devoted years to writing those books on those kind of characters. So fair play to them.
Brian, your ears are burning there. We get a good insight into the challenges of commemoration by looking at the Thomas Kent story, that these things, it's not always easy to have someone remembered, and it's very easy for a figure to be kind of sidelined for long periods.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. And in some ways, we can't remember everything. And that's one of the real challenges, you know, with 16 names. If you're asked to write 16 names down in the middle of a quiz, people, I think, would struggle with that, no matter how well you knew the period. So people are always going to fall through the cracks. I mean, Cork, certainly the Kents, as it was often said, redeemed Cork in 1916, or gave Cork its rising in 1916. But, you know, there are very many people from the later period in Cork as well, who could very easily take the commemorative limelight as well. So commemoration is always about choices, and there's only certain people can take in at any given time. And, you know, with someone like Kent again, 2015 was perhaps his moment in the sun. Might also be worth mentioning William Rowe was the head constable who's killed. It'd be interesting to think about what Kent's legacy might have been if Rowe hadn't died. Kent would have, you know, been arrested for sure and may have been released by David and William were. Was he a little bit too an active guerrilla in the War of Independence? Would he just remembered for his landly work? So, in a sense, without the death of Constable William Rowe, we might be having this conversation at all. So, as much as he's forgotten, he gets remembered. The fact that he is worthy as categorised amongst the 1916 leaders, I think, is interesting in itself.
Very good. And apologies, there's some issues with the line there. But and John, it's interesting as well that the legacy is partly the 1916 contribution, but it's also that Land League contribution in an earlier period, that it's a much broader life story and life contribution.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much, they very much represent part of the kind of that early pre-revolution independence movement, people who were involved in a lot of things, going back to the Land League, the Plan of Campaign, jail terms, being celebrated for going to jail for your beliefs. But then also, you know, Thomas Kent also had, you know, he'd lived in Boston for a while. He'd lived in South Africa briefly. So kind of that mobility and that kind of global perspective of the influences that are coming to play. I just wanted to say something about the commemoration that struck me at the time, and then later I thought that partially because of the location of the body, the defense forces were really at the forefront, and I think it was really I think a lot of people were concerned leading up to the centenary of the Rising about how the government and how the state were going to handle it, and I think that was the first indication to a lot of folks that it was going to be handled quite well. And the ceremony was remarkable. And I don't know if you remember the eulogy. It was given by Jerry White, who at the time was a member of the Defense Forces. He's one of the real outstanding historians of the Revolutionary period and a military historian. And so to give a historian kind of the mic at that key moment rather than, you know, a politician trying to make hay of it, I thought was a real reflection of the attitude the government was going to take, which I think in retrospect we all agree was a successful commemorative year. But the time leading up to it, a lot of people were quite nervous about how it was going to be handled. And the state commemoration, I think, was the first kind of good sign to what was to come.
And Lorcan, I might leave the final word with you. A Cork hero, but very much an Irish hero as well.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fantastic that there's a whole new generation who remember him, and long may his memory be kept alive.
Okay, well, it's always very easy presenting the show whenever we cover the revolutionary period, because there are so many brilliant historians who are always willing to give up their time and share their expertise with us. Very grateful to Meadha Ryan for joining us earlier. She is, of course, the author of the biography Thomas Kent. Very grateful to Sean Enright, who has done so much to explore the legalities and the illegalities of the various court-martials. And then the panel that has been with us for the full hour, three brilliant historians on the Irish Revolution, Dr. Brian Hughes, author of Michael Mallon, Dr. John Borgonovo, one of the geniuses behind the Atlas of the Irish Revolution, and Lorcan Collins, behind the 1916 Rebellion Walking Tour and the new podcast, Revolutionary Ireland. My thanks to everyone. We've been talking history. Thanks to Susan Cahill, my producer, Peter Malloy on sound. We have a good one for you next week. We'll be investigating the life and death of ancient cities. We'll also be exploring the history of Ireland in international relations and lots more besides. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.